Welcome to Migrant Matters Radio. I'm Mary Carl Giao. Dr. Kim Anderson's book, Life Stages and Native Women, Memories, Teachings, and Story Medicine, launched into Turtle Island and the world beyond this year. It's a book many of us wish our parental figures would have read to us growing up. This fall, Dr. Anderson graced us with her presence for a book reading at the Aboriginal Resource Center at the University of Guelph. You just heard the live music that Kim and her son, Rajan, had played at the celebration. In the next hour, you will hear about the importance of having respect and appreciation for the different things women bring at different points along the life stage continuum, as taught by Métis, Cree, and Ojibwe stories, also known as medicines that remind us of our strength. On a larger scale, her book imparts theories from Ojibwe life stage teachings, emphasizing that health and well-being are dependent on how well community members fulfill life stage roles and responsibilities, and that the feminine and stories are powerful healing forces in the decolonization and recovery of Aboriginal communities. Dr. Kim Anderson is a Cree Métis writer and educator. She is recognized as an advocate of Indigenous women and has devoted her career to researching and writing about the health and well-being of Indigenous families. She is currently an associate professor in Indigenous studies at Wilfrid Laurier University in Bradford, Ontario.
I'm really happy to be here because this book is actually grew out of my PhD thesis, and I did my PhD here at Guelph, and actually I wrote the book down the hall, so it's kind of cool being in the place where I wrote the book. And I've been on tour basically since Labor Day. I've been in Western Canada, all over the place. So this is my 13th event or something like that, which is kind of nice to come home and be in this place where it was all born. So we started out by playing some Métis fiddle music mostly. Most of it comes from Métis people in Western Canada. And we thought we'd do it just so people could have a little party environment and have some food and that kind of thing. But also because the fiddling music actually grew out of the research from the PhD. Because what happened was, the book is based on an oral history I did with elders here in Ontario. And Renee Mishaki's here. He's one of the elders I worked with. But it was also elders in Western Canada, mostly in Saskatchewan, that I worked with. And so I spent a fair bit of time living in Saskatchewan and going back and forth. And as with, it's always challenging being a parent and trying to do your work, right, and be a mom at the same time. So I tried to do things in the summer and take my family with me. So my whole family went out on the kind of research trail with me. And one of the things that happened while we were out in Saskatchewan and I was supposed to be actually gathering interviews and doing oral history, what happened is we ended up becoming recruited into Maria Campbell's shows about Métis culture. And Maria Campbell's an author and a playwright and elder, a well-known Cree Métis grandmother across the country and activist and so on. And so Maria was one of the people I worked with quite closely on the book. I interviewed her as one of the elders in the book, and I'm going to start by reading some of her words in the foreword. So we were out, and we were staying at Maria's house because she was kind of hosting us while I was supposedly doing interviews for my book. And she had some shows going on out at Batoche National Historic Site, which is it's the site where the resistance, the 1885 resistance took place, right? The battles took place And Maria does a lot of work around reviving Métis culture through the arts, and in particular through performance, song, you know, music, theater, all that kind of stuff. So we were out there camped out at her place, and my son Rajan, who was playing, is a violinist, and she said, well, if you learn some Métis songs, I'll put you in my show next summer, right? Because we went there quite a bit. And so he did, and she put him in her show, so he was actually playing out at the historic site in full period costume. And then I ended up doing things, because when you go out there, Maria will recruit you for things. So she's like, and you'll be the storyteller. I'm like, okay. So anyway, that's why we wanted to share this, because we were doing this before I started the PhD research and what became the book. We weren't doing Métis fiddle music, and it grew out of our engagement and the research. And I guess it's really an example of how, when you're doing scholarship as an Indigenous person or Indigenous scholarship and storytelling, it's a much bigger process, and especially doing oral history, it's a much bigger process than just simply going out and collecting data, and then, you know, you go home and you write your thing and you get your degree or whatever. It's almost like this parallel process of engagement with the culture and the learning, the traditional stuff that you learn. And in the case of working with Maria, it's the arts, right? Traditional arts that you learn along the way. So there's this whole, I mean, I got a PhD, I wrote a book, but there's this whole other level of engagement and learning in Métis culture, in particular in Western Canada, that came out as a result. So now Rajan and I have a little fiddling act that we do, and he was playing, and I thought, well, I guess I better, since I'm at all his gigs, I may as well learn how to play the piano and accompany him. So if it sounds a little rusty, it's because I've been playing for about a year. So it's all to encourage people to say it's never too late, and there's many ways in which we can pick up pieces of our culture and get involved in them and have it come alive and have a spirit to it. So that's what we wanted to share with you. So I'm going to do, since this is a book launch, I'm going to do some actual reading from the book. I'm not going to lecture away too much. I will talk about the process of the book. And then we can have maybe some questions after, and, you know, food and all those kind of things. Party time again. And thank you for bringing the baby. That's so nice to see. Especially she was enjoying the music. She's like looking at the fiddle. They respond to it. So the book's called Life Stages in Native Women, Memory Teachings and Story Medicine. And it's based on interviews I did. I worked with 14 elders doing oral history and asking them about their childhood communities in the 30s, 40s, and 50s in Ontario and in the prairies. So those elders came from Ontario and the prairies. Like I say, Renee is here. He's one of the elders I worked with. And it really grew out of some curiosity I had around Native women and identity that came out of my first book that I wrote, which was called Recognition of Being, Reconstructing Native Womanhood. And I had, this model I developed about how we get to that feeling of that sort of identity of magnificence. You know, how do we get to be these beautiful, shiny human beings? And in particular for Native women, and in spite of all the obstacles that they encounter along the way. But when I finished writing that book, I had this yearning to think more about identity, not just in terms of gender, but also age. And how our identities, like all of us, right, we have different identities along the life stage continuum. We're not the same person when we're in a little one like this, and we're not the same person when we're 15 and when we're 35 and when we're 65 and 85, right? And of course, all all cultures have theories about life stages and what those life stages mean. So if you take a psychology class, you learn about Erikson or whatever. But the, you know, Indigenous people have their own, Indigenous peoples of various cultures have their own theories about life stages too. And so the one I worked with was the Ojibwe or Anishinaabeg in general have life stage teachings that they give around what our roles and responsibilities are at each stage along the life stage continuum. So for example, like the little ones, they have a job to do, which is to bring joy, right? And she's doing a particularly good job because she's so cute, right? So when she comes in, you feel happy, you feel joy. That's a really important job to do. And so the life stage teachings talk about that, right? They talk about those things that we bring at different points along the continuum. And the teachings are quite complex, and I don't even have my license to be, you know, telling all of it, because there's certain things you have to do to gain the right to tell that story in those teachings. But there's been people that have written a bit about it, and I had been learning about this through workshops that I'd attended in Aboriginal community organizations over the years, and it just always struck me how beautiful these teachings were, and partly because they really value everybody, and they value all the little guys, and they value the older people. And I think sometimes in mainstream society, those people become invisible, or they become marginalized, or they're considered not to be as important or significant in terms of the roles and what they offer. And so in listening to these teachings over the years, I thought, wow, that's really beautiful about how the health of the collective and the well-being is dependent on how well we fulfill these jobs that we have to do along the life stage continuum, right? But I wonder, listen to all this theory, and I'm like, well, I wonder what this would look like actually on the ground. Like, what does it look like how these stages of life are fulfilled, and in particular for women and girls? So that's what I went out to ask elders who could talk about living in land-based communities in the middle of 20th century, and say, what did people do when women became pregnant? How did they treat people like that? What did they do when there was babies? What kind of ceremonies were there? What were the practices? And what kind of work did little girls do? And then what happened with women? Like, what was their roles and responsibilities? And what about elderly women? What about them? What were their roles and responsibilities along the way? And it really fed into my understanding more about identity, in my own even, but also about how our identities as a collective feed into the health of everybody. It's important for her to bring us joy because it feeds into the health of everybody, right? It's important to have those babies and children around. So I structured the book, and I took all these stories that I gathered from the elders, and I looked in, anthropological material, I looked at literature, and I wove them all into these sections in the book that talk about, the early years, like infancy and all those things, and then children, what were the child-rearing practices, what did they look like, and then women, and then elders or grandmothers. So there's lots of good stuff in there. So I learned a lot about the content, about what I was looking for, but I also learned about stories and how story worked. And I learned that by sitting with these elders that I worked with, by learning the process of being a listener to story and learning the process of how what story means in Indigenous history telling. So I've talked about Maria Campbell and how significant she was in terms of hosting me and my family and teaching me a lot about story. So I'm going to read a bit from the foreword that she wrote for the book, because I think it's a really important spirit that it really talks about what the book is about all these stories. So here's from Maria. Like many women of my generation, I grew up with stories, lots of them in all kinds. Some were nonsensical, others were riddles. There were Atayokawina, the sacred stories, and others that were the family histories. But it was the stories about the women that I loved best, stories about strong, courageous women and about weak, foolish ones, stories of births and deaths, of women's cycles, of bad love affairs, brutal husbands, and yes, strong and gentle men. Some of the stories were told while we worked, cutting up meat and packing jars for canning, or while smoking and drying fish. And some were told on the way to the berry patch. Look, that's the place where your cousin Jenny was born, the story went. Your auntie was craving Saskatoon berries, but she was told by her mother and the old midwives not to go berry picking because she was almost ready to deliver her first baby. Of course she didn't listen, the Mutsiquan that she was. She snuck away. Well, wouldn't you know it, another Mutsiquan, a young black bear, had slipped away from her mother. And, like your Auntie Betsy, was gobbling berries as fast as she could. When your Auntie Betsy came around the bush, she bumped right into her. They both screamed and ran. I don't know what happened to the young black bear, but your Auntie Betsy tripped and fell, and not long after, Jenny arrived. Good thing Betsy had a good set of lungs. Her mother said she was screaming so loud, her voice echoed all over the valley. It was hard to know if one woman was having a baby or 10. Yes, this is Jenny's berry patch. Our Nokums would laugh whenever they stopped at the place where they found Betsy. To this very day, that particular place on the side of the hill is still called Jenny's Berry Patch. It is one of the family and landscape stories of our area. I loved all these stories, and whenever I saw two women together, old or young, I was there like a shot, pushing my hair behind my ear and listening as hard as I could so I wouldn't miss anything. The place to hear the best stories was with my Cheechum and Nokums and their old lady friends and relatives. I danced with excitement when these friends and relatives began arriving to spend a week or two or three with us, as they did every summer. While Dad was putting up the big tent for them, I helped my Nokums carry bedding inside, for they always moved into the tent with the visitors, and I, as their helper, moved in with them. And she's saying my Nokums, that's her grandmother's, eh? All these old ladies. As we spread the floor covering and blankets down, my Cheechum, who's her great-grandmother, always made my bed beside her. I would be happy knowing that the Nokums wouldn't try to chase me away if I was by her side and the discussion was getting too risque. Some of the old ladies were midwives and medicine women, meaning they knew and doctored with plants. One of them was also a ceremonialist. They were, with the exception of my Cheechum, all practicing Catholics and Anglicans, which was not uncommon in those days. They were all deeply spiritual rather than religious, but at the same time they were completely sacrilegious. They ate, gambled, and sewed while they visited and told one story after another. Some were so scary they would make your hair stand on end, and others so sad you wanted to cry. Some were so outrageous you laughed till you were sick, as I often do today when I get together with my cousin Hillary and we retell these stories while we sew and bead. Even the funny ones, when the two of us discuss them, contemplate them, or have ceremony with them, will open doors to knowledge we thought was lost to us. When this happens, it's like a miracle, and we are in awe. So I spent some time with Maria and her cousin Hillary sitting around on winter nights and so on, listening to them talking, telling stories, because they have the same grandmother on one of the sides. So then I'm just going to read a little bit more from Maria, talking about how the stories are really a healing power in our communities. For a time, I left those ways behind, believing they could never be part of this new life. I got into trouble in the city, and for a while I was lost. But times were changing in the 1960s, especially in Indian country. The old people had become radicals, or so they were called by some officials. They traveled the country holding cultural and spiritual teaching sessions wherever they could find a space, and young people came from everywhere, hungry for their knowledge. It was the stories that brought us back and launched what we now know as the Aboriginal Healing Movement. Their stories taught us to decolonize ourselves and reclaim our communities. Through them, we were then able to engage in our own radical activity, because the old people and their stories brought us a sense of safety and gave us courage. I felt this when, lost and sick, I came home and attended my first sweat lodge. It was conducted by an old lady, and when she sang the opening song, I knew I was home and I was going to be okay. So stories carry a power, and I learned about that power, eh, working with all these storytellers. One of the other elders I worked with is a Soto elder named Danny Musqua, who lives in Saskatoon. He's from Kisikoos First Nation. Fabulous storyteller and knowledge keeper. And I actually had worked with him on a bunch of other things, other papers. I always laugh because I say, well, I had my spiritual epiphany in the Red Lobster one night, because we were there, and one of Maria Campbell's friends had wanted to meet Danny and ask him some questions for a paper he was writing on law, actually. So he wanted to talk to Danny about traditional law. So he goes, so okay, Danny likes fish, so we go to the Red Lobster of all places in Saskatoon. And this guy asks Danny this question. And of course, Danny, you know, when you ask elders a question, they don't necessarily answer it. What they'll do is often tell you a story or what seems to the newcomer to be a tangent, which isn't really a tangent. It's what you need to know, right? But anyway, so Danny goes off on this thing, and he told the creation story as his people know it. And like I say, it was like a spiritual epiphany for me, because I was just like, my jaw dropped just listening to him. First of all, he was very enrapturing the way he tells the story, but it was about the sacred feminine. And I thought, you know, this is so powerful, because it talks about the power of women in a way that it's not a threatening power. It's not a power that needs to be squashed or killed. It's a power that's recognized. And he's just sitting there with his lobster, you know, telling this story about the power of the sacred feminine and how it's built into their creation story. So anyway, I went back to him and I used that for another piece I wrote, actually, about stories and Native women's bodies. And it was another thing. And eventually I ended up working with him on this book. But while I was interviewing him for this other paper, this is what he said to me. We never had any doubt that women were the center and core of our community and our nation. No nation ever existed without the fortitude of our grandmothers. And all of those teachings have to be somehow recovered. And it will be up to these young people, well, like yourself, he tells me as I'm sitting there. Young women that are just digging up and going around. They've got to dig up the medicines to heal the people. And the medicines in this case are the teachings. They've got to dig them up. You've got to find them. Danny didn't know, but at the time that he said this to me, as I was sitting there and I was having trouble finding people to talk to. I was in Saskatchewan for like 7 weeks, and I've dragged my family there and everything, and feeling really discouraged about trying to do this work. But when he said that to me, I'm like, okay, that's why I'm doing this. I've got to keep going. I've got to keep digging. And I'm one of many people who's doing this type of work. So I kept going and I kept digging and talking to people and looking for the stories. And I did find at the end, you know, I thought as I was going along, oh, I'm not finding what I need, but I found when I started looking at it all came together. And so some of the stuff I found that I had been looking for had to do with, you know, ceremonies that happen along the life stage continuum. You know, when I was a new mom and I had young kids, I really felt a need to learn more about, you know, pregnancy protocols, ceremonies for infants, like all those cultural practices that we sometimes don't have because, you know, the line of education was broken through colonization. And sometimes we don't always have elders that we can go and ask or people that can guide us through those stages. And especially as a mom in the early stages of my kids' lives, I really felt a need to learn some of that. And I didn't have anywhere that was easy. So I've written a bunch of that stuff in a book because it's the kind of thing I wish I would have found when I was looking for that stuff around the earliest stages of life, right? So I found some of that in, of course, talking to the elders all about, you know, naming ceremonies. And I found stuff actually in the ethnographic material too. I started looking. I'm like, wow, actually, there's lots of stuff in here about all those ceremonial practices that we're trying to dig up, right? So I pieced it together. And I'm going to just jump to some stuff I found around puberty. So, you know, I had known that in most indigenous cultures in North America, menstruation is considered a real power, right? It's a power time. It's a cleansing ceremony. There's nothing dirty or shameful about it. It's a really significant power that women have, and it's related to the life force, and it's related to life-giving abilities. And so this is a power that was respected and honored pretty much across the board if you look at indigenous societies traditionally, historically, and still is, of course. I'm talking historically, but you know, we're bringing these things back as well as the knowledge back, and people have practiced it. So anyway, it's a power that's considered so strong that you don't go around certain ceremonial items, you don't go to certain places, because what it does is it will tangle with those other types of power, that those other powers that, in terms, especially masculine energies, it will tangle with that, right? So you're not supposed to be in certain environments. So all of this I had known just, you know, through the knowledge I've gained through the community, but what I didn't know was that that power is considered especially strong at the first menstruation when girls go through puberty. It's considered strong enough to heal and strong enough to kill. It's a really strong power time. And so that's why if you look at societies all across North America, there was always these seclusions where girls on their first time would go out in the bush typically and spend 4 to 10 days out there. And they would be visited by elderly women and they would have work to do and they would learn about and have time to reflect, right? It's a retreat time where you reflect on that power and who you are in your life and so on. And so I wondered how many of the people that I talked to in the 30s, 40s, and 50s had practices like this going on in their community still. What did it look like? And so people were telling stories about, you know, they might not be off in the bush anymore, but they might have been like behind a curtain in their family home. And, you know, they were talking about these practices they'd had around the puberty ceremonies. And one of the things that I found in literature was that there's a woman that had done she wrote a whole book actually on that puberty ceremony for girls in the southern, mostly in the southern states, indigenous people. And she said, this is something that was considered, it wasn't only health for the health of the girl, but it was about the health of the community. And it was about health, in fact, of the whole universe. Because what she did at that time had a significant impact on the health of creation. And so she's making that sacrifice and that work that she does has to do with the life-giving force of creation, right? Which is incredible power when you think about it. And so different from what, you know, often people get like just around that time generally, right? Which is not really a lot. Anyway, I was reading about that. She was saying how because this was considered such a significant power in terms of the universe, often in some cultures, the girls would be asked to do healing. So I found actually in the literature around Wasoxing, Parry Sound, like in central Ontario, this material around some of the healing stuff that girls at pubescence had done with people. And then one of the elders I was working with actually told me a story that corresponded to that, that she remembered it from her sister's time. So I'm just going to read a little bit about that story from Marie Anderson. Marie told a story in which she was witness to a healing provided by her sister about 20 years after the anthropologist Diamond Jenness had been in their community. So what Marie told me, they brought this man from Deep River and put him in a little shed outside our house. I remember they brought my sister out. They had her fasting upstairs, so her sister was on her seclusion, right? It was the last day, and they took her in that little shed. Of course, I had to see what was going on. His legs were bad. This was a returned soldier from the Second World War. I guess he got a spinal injury somewhere and his legs just went. And you know what? They pulled his pants up like that, she said, and she bit him. They told her to bite him hard, and she said, "It's so hot, my teeth are going to fall out." I could see him because I was peeking in the door there. She bit him all the way up and all the way back down. After that, they got her to go like that, and Maurice explaining this to me in her story, she makes this pulling motion, like she was pulling something out of him. So then I say, Marie finished her story by saying that the healing worked because he walked after that. So this power that was recognized and honored by the community, this power of girls and women, and that life-giving force, that sacred, it's based in the sacred feminine. I wondered, okay, well, how would this impact on other members of the community in terms of the way they understood girls and women? And Renee shared some stories with me about being a young boy and being witness to these things happening. And I just want to read about, I want to read some of what, related to what Renee told me. Renee became aware of the girls' changes in status when they came out of seclusion. When grandmother took my cousins away, they called it Kichikwewe, he explained. We wouldn't see them for a while and we would wonder where they went. Kichikwewe, they were having their first moon. After she came home, she's Kichikwe. She's a woman now. So I say, these concepts of Kichi meaning great and Kwe meaning woman delineate a new role for Renee's cousins, and it changed his relationship with them. He talked about how this grounded his identity as Anishinaabe, the term used to signify the Ojibwe, but which translates to from whence, Lord, the male of the species. Reflecting on the humility he carried with respect to Mother Earth and to older women in particular, Renee mused, I often think what Anishinaabe means, Anish, to lower the man. These names lower us, they imply that women were always here. And us guys, we need to have that balance. For this reason, when Renee's cousins returned as Kichikwe, it implied a new respect and a role for him as a boy in relation to them as great women. As Renee's story indicates, girls' puberty ceremonies were significant in terms of teaching boys about the respect that was due to women in their communities. Renee laments the loss of these customs, which in his community occurred when they moved from their traditional homeland onto a reserve. He is aware of how this respect for women has been lost. You talk about two worlds. When you're on the res now, that thing is not taught. There is no more Kichikwewe, and I think that's why they get beat up sometimes. There's violence all over the place. So it still gives me chills just to think about that teaching that Renee gave me and telling that and the things that he's taught me about the sacred feminine in really an utterly different world when you think about it that he's talking about and that he grew up in and that we can learn from. You know, how do we reinstill that sense of respect and balance and honor in our communities that now indeed are plagued with epidemic levels of violence and violence against women? And so I wanted to share that because I think it's really significant what it can mean in terms of change and how our elders have knowledge and storytelling and can relate things from their past that will help us envision the future. So once girls went through this puberty, they were entered the women's circle. You know, there wasn't this prolonged period of adolescence like we have now. And they basically, you know, they started working, doing the work of women, which was a lot of physical stuff to maintain the community. And so a lot of the stuff I collected for the women's section was really about the work that women did, and people worked really hard. So at one point I said to people, well, what did people do for fun? It sounds like they did a lot of work. You know, they're tanning hides and hauling stuff around, and, you know, what did they do for fun? So I'm going to read you a little bit about gambling. We're talking about gambling. And this is in Western Canada. Gambling was popular and has historical traditions among women. Fine Day, who was an informant for anthropologists in the early 1900s, he was a Cree man who was talking about the 1800s. Fine Day described the gambling that used to go on between women in the late 1800s when people got together in big camps. Some of these gatherings had horse racing, and Fine Day was notable for his skills in these competitions. He reported that, quote, all the Crees from the reserves bet on me. He also provided evidence that the women actively bet on the horses when he said, the Cree women bet their dishes against the dried meat of the Soto women. In the historian participants' childhood communities, gambling had been banned by the church, but community members found a way to do it anyway. Hillary shared a story about being a young child and spending her summers on the Mooseman Reserve, just outside of Cochin, Saskatchewan. She and her granny would sneak off into the woods to meet others so they could gamble all night. Her story shows community cohesion as well as resistance to the oppressive conditions Aboriginal people were living with in the 1950s. And Hillary explained, this is the story she told to me one night. They always had a secret little meeting place in the bush where they would get together. Granny would wait until it was the dead of night. She would have our blankets that we would be sleeping in and her gambling stuff and a little bit of food. She was tiny, but she would carry that on her back. We had to be totally quiet because the priest had spies in the community. And you had to make like you were just going to visit somebody. I was instructed never to talk. No matter who it was, I wasn't to talk to them. Just act shy. I remember sometimes being tired and starting to cry. No, I'm tired. I don't want to walk any further. So on top of all the stuff she was carrying, she'd throw me up there and she'd carry me. Pretty soon there would be young men who came to meet us. One young man would carry me and the other young man would carry her blankets all the rest of the way to the gambling site. When we got there, she would put out her blankets around where they were sitting and I would curl up around her legs and sleep. I'd wake up once in a while and hear gambling by the bitch lamp or whatever. They would be laughing and talking and carrying on. I remember looking forward to the morning time because there'd be kids to play with. So then I go on, because she was telling me this story when her and Maria and I were sitting together one winter night. So Maria remembered that her mothers and aunts played poker with one another for beadwork or embroidery. And this is in the Rhodelance communities in northern Saskatchewan. Maria talked about how these goods would circulate around the community as women won and then lost the same goods repeatedly amongst themselves. It was kind of a joke, she said. My one auntie would have everything tonight, and tomorrow night someone else would have it. Whatever my mother lost, she would usually win it all back by spring. Hearing this story, Hillary commented, I think that's where my Nokum got a lot of her fabric. Maria made an important distinction, though, about the type of gambling that was done in her childhood and the kind of gambling she sees now. In First Nations communities, casinos have become a source of revenue and entertainment. In Maria's estimation, gambling was historically used as a way to bring people together and to distribute and redistribute goods. So it's just like this part of the collective and distribution. In those days, she said, you didn't starve to death because you were gambling. You didn't leave your kids. It's not the same now. The Wakotawin, which is kinship or relationship building, is gone from gambling, where it used to be part of it. Hillary and Maria reflected on how gambling had once been a sacred activity among Plains people, and they pondered whether or not it had once been one of the safer, quote, ceremonies that people could practice in their time, like during the middle of the century. As Maria pointed out, even though it was against the law with the church, you wouldn't get punished the same way if you were caught gambling as if you were caught in a Sundance ceremony. So that's the fun in the women's circle. And then I'll go to the grandmothers and the elders for the older women. And of course, you know, we know in Indigenous communities that elders are really revered and honored because of their position as sort of the life and spirit teachers in our communities, right? So we always include elders in the leadership decisions. They're our teachers, they're the knowledge keepers, and so on. So, you know, this I knew, but what I was wondering was, okay, what about women elders in particular, or the old ladies, as they call them? What distinct authorities, responsibilities, powers did they have, and especially in these communities of the elders that were remembering back? So I was asking to remember the old ladies in their communities. And so people talked about, of course, them being teachers. And so I have stuff in here about how they were teachers and the ways in which they were engaging with young kids. They talked about them in terms of governance roles. There's some wonderful storytelling here from Renee talking about the old ladies in his traditional community and how they were really like a governing body. And again, this is really significant in terms of recognizing how this world operates in which the sacred feminine is still engaged, right? Because elderly women, by virtue of the fact that they're senior life givers, are understood to have a governing responsibility and authority, and people listen to them. You know, and so I was saying to somebody, I was doing an interview with somebody today, and I said, you know, if you start to look at how these worlds were working, you know, we can learn things from that because, you know, how many old ladies do you see up on Parliament Hill who have authority, right? I mean, older women tend to be marginalized and invisible in our societies and considered not to have a whole lot that's important to offer in terms of, you know, leadership and governance. But if you begin to look at these communities where this is still operational, it's really amazing to see how it worked and how their position was really honored because of that understanding of them in that role as the senior life givers. So there's some really neat stuff around that, and that role that they have between being teachers of the transitions between life and death. Maria Campbell talked about how they have this thing called old lady hunting. It's an actual term in Cree, and she said that it was the old ladies that taught the little guys how to hunt, like right from an early age, from maybe 3, 4, like setting their little snares and stuff like that. And she said it was considered really important for youngsters to learn about killing animals from the senior life givers. because in worlds in which life is revered and honored, it's not taken for granted, and you don't just go out shooting and killing things and, you know, leave half the animal there and take what you need. No, that's not how it operated, right? It's this whole notion around the sacredness of life, respect for taking life. And so Maria said we had what was called old lady hunting, and it was the old ladies that taught you how to hunt at first in her community, because you needed to learn about taking life from people who had that senior life-giving authority. Women, of course, having that life-giving ability, because the ability to be pregnant and carry life and, you know, mother the youngest ones, right? The other responsibilities that I talked to was what I called the doorkeepers to the spirit world. Again, it was the elderly ladies who were considered to have that authority and position to be able to catch new life coming in and to see it on its way out. So what Maria Campbell said was, what she said about doorkeepers, if I can find it. Men were not part of birth and death. They didn't stay for that. It was the women who took care of the birthing. It was an old lady that brings you in and an old lady that takes you out. And according to them, on the other side, on the spirit side, it's an old lady that welcomes you. There's a midwife, grandmother, on that side to bring you back to the spirit world. So in Cree teachings that I've heard elsewhere, there's this notion of the lake, the spirit lake, where when you come through and there's a grandmother who's the keeper of that lake. And so when you're born, you come through that way and the grandmother sends you, and there's a grandmother, literally in these communities, an old lady, right, midwife, who's there to catch you coming in from the granny that sends you from the other side. And then likewise, when death happened in a lot of these communities, it was the old ladies who were like the funeral home. They were the undertakers, actually. They're the ones that dealt with the dead bodies, washed them. And they actually had, in some communities, medicines that were old lady medicines that they used to deal with birth and death, those transition medicines. And Maria told me about, there was actually a lake in her territory in northern Saskatchewan called Nutukwayat Nsakaikan, which is the old lady lake. And she remembered going there as a kid, and that's where they picked the medicines that they used to work with death and with birth. And she said, as kids, we were allowed to go and jump and splash around in the water and stuff. We actually had to be really walk gently around the earth. Like, this was the old lady medicine area and the old lady lake, right? So all these things are woven in with the land, the responsibilities, and the reverence for life that's built into that. So I'll just read a little story about birth, which has to do with the presence of older women needing to be there around this transition time. So Maria told a story that she had heard from a Métis woman in northern Saskatchewan, which further demonstrates how the presence of older women at birth was valued. This woman said all the old ladies came when she was having her baby. She said they built a fire outside and made a big pot of duck soup, and they laughed and told stories all night and all the next day. And the harder she screamed, the harder they laughed and the more ducks they ate. She was telling me she just felt like wringing their necks. But what it did was, by them laughing so loud and everything else, she didn't have time to think that much about her pain, because she couldn't believe they were doing this to her. And she said it wasn't until she was an old lady that she realized how much they had helped her by doing that, by letting her know that life goes on. It was important for her to know that she wasn't going to die. On reflection, Maria thought this to be part of a ceremony of birthing that was aimed at helping women feel good about the birth, particularly in the Christian environment at the time, where, as Maria remembered, everything having to do with birthing was associated with evil and death and bad and considered unclean. She noted that the presence of the old ladies might have helped to communicate to the mother that she was doing something remarkable and full of life. So when you think about this, it's like an act of resistance against patriarchal and really violent ways of thinking about women's bodies and knowledge and that presence of transition and the sacred feminine. And these old ladies were resisting by bringing in that spirit of it's about life and it's life-giving thing. But more than that, once I start to look at these stories, I see about how it was positioning these older women, how significant it was considered for them to be in those positions around transitions of life and death. And so I have stories in here too about some of the elders remembering their grannies, looking after the bodies, doing the undertaking work in their communities and the roles that they had. Roles as medicine women and doctors. They were often the healthcare, like they were the doctors in the community, largely through use of plant medicine. And again, that's another thing that's considered part of the authority and responsibility of women, is to work with that medicine in many indigenous societies. So they would be working with plant medicine to help doctor. And Rose Fleury, who's from Duck Lake, Saskatchewan, she told lots of stories about her great-grandmother in the 30s, the 1930s, and Duck Lake was this bustling town with settler population from all sorts of different European nations, Métis people and First Nations people all living in this bustling town in the 1930s. And there was a white doctor, and there was her great-grandmother, and they were like the two docs in the community, and they would kind of help each other out. And so when you think about that, you know, we don't learn this in history books. We don't know about this, about the significant role that Native women played in the health and well-being, right? So I started to see through the stories, too, that whereas mothers in a lot of these communities were looking after the health of the family, it was the old ladies who were looking after the health of the collective. And so Danny Musco was talking about how he remembered the old ladies actually doing rounds in the community and lots of memory about that kind of stuff. So very cool, very, very life-affirming, you know, when you think about that. So I'm going to just finish with reading a little bit from my conclusion, because when I talked at the beginning about how the stories carry a healing power and how I went around trying to dig up these medicines, not just to figure out how we can be more life-affirming, how we can work in a way that values the sacred feminine, but also how do we recover as Indigenous people from all that happened in terms of all the violence and the destruction that came in through colonization, all the stuff that created situations of crisis in our communities. What do we do? How do we take this history and try to weave it in and build it into our lives even as we sit here today, right, living here today as we are in Guelph? And, you know, it's been a personal thing for me, too, about trying to build this into my own life and my community. But after I had finished writing the book, I gave a copy to this Anishinaabe psychologist named Jane Middleton Moss, and she goes all over Indian country, all over Canada and the States, doing healing work and community-based trauma intervention and stuff like that. And so I said, well, Jane, what do you think about how we can use this history and weave it into the work that we're doing in the healing movement? So there's stuff in here that is part of our conversation around how do you build that in. And I don't think I'll read from that. I think I'll just read about what my intention is. Then we can talk, we can have questions, whatever. I began this book with intentions of digging up the medicines that might further contribute to the healing and decolonization of our communities. As I finish, I can offer some reflections on how I address these goals, with the hope that others will be inspired to engage in the dialogue and work through their own reflections and conclusions. In chapter 2, I refer to the work of Keith Basso, who documented how stories, quote, work like arrows among the Apache. My hope is that as I launch this book into Indian country and the world beyond, it will work like an arrow, piercing the injustices of our past and slicing open more avenues for change. I encourage each reader to dig out the medicines that suit his or her particular needs and to continue to dig, as there's so much more to learn. So thank you, everybody. Thank you for listening.
That was Dr. Kim Anderson at her book launch in Guelph, Ontario. Her latest book is Life Stages and Native Women, Memories, Teachings, and Story Medicine. Dr. Anderson has a PhD in history and, along with other published scholarly works, fiction and poetry, she has authored the book A Recognition of Being, Reconstructing Native Womanhood, and is the co-editor with Bonita Lawrence of Strong Women Stories, Native Vision and Community Survival. I'm Mary Carl Gale. Thank you for listening.